Before we dive into today's incredible episode, I wanted to remind you of some exciting things I have coming up. This fall, I'm teaching a retreat in Spain with best-selling authors Molly Weisenberg and Hallie Bateman. It's from October 26th through November 2nd, and it's called Tiny True Stories and Sketches, a Micro-Memoir Retreat. It is filling up fast, my friends, so you'll definitely want to check it out. If international travel is not in your future, never fear. I am leading a retreat this August 24th through 28th through the Madeline Island School of the Arts in Wisconsin. This one is called Craft Your Best Draft, a revision retreat where we spend the entire week transforming your draft into a polished, publication-ready piece. And I teach my proven three-step method of revising that has helped thousands of writers transform their drafts. If online opportunities are more your jam, I've got some things for you there too. I teach a weekly writer workout for women writers where I give a craft talk and we have in-class writing time. And then I also lead multi-week workshops and I do one-on-one coaching and manuscript consultations. You can find out all the information at NadineKennyJohnstone.com. This is Heart of the Story, and I'm Nadine Kenny Johnstone. I'm an author and a holistic writing coach who talks with today's top women writers about how to navigate life when things don't go according to plan. These impactful conversations and personal reflections invite you to be seen, feel supported, and ultimately fall back in love with yourself. So let's go together to that honest, powerful place. The heart of the story. Hi, friends. I've been so inspired by sharing my essays with you, as I've been doing every month, bringing back old essays that I originally performed on this show, that I wanted to keep doing that, but with some of my new writing. And you know how I think it's maybe VH1 that has the behind the music type shows. This feels like behind the writing, behind the essay. In that, I wanted to share something I recently posted on Substack, and then I wanted to break down the writerly choices that I made and the inspiration behind it. I always find it really interesting to just see what inspired an artistic work, whether it's a painting or a song or a sculpture, and how the artist went about creating it and making it better. And so I wanted to do that with a piece of writing that I wrote recently and published, as I said, on Substack on Valentine's Day. I'll walk you through not only the essay, but all the choices I made along the way. Here is my essay called Sometimes It's Just Hard. A couple of nights ago after work, Jamie and I sat down at our dining room table to make a spreadsheet of all the tasks needed to prep for our move. After renting for almost 4 years in our little beach town, we're finally in the process of purchasing a home here, and it's not bringing out the best in me. Our 12-year-old was in his playroom blasting Imagine Dragons and doing his homework. Our dogs were napping in their bed, and our pasta bake leftovers were resting in foil on the counter, about to be warmed up. It's a good life, this life we've built. Jamie had made a brainstorm doc of moving tasks with two columns, one with things like forward mail and switch utilities, and another with the initials of who might be in charge of said task, J, N, or both. As we sat side by side in front of our computers, I looked over the list, grateful that he'd taken the initiative to create it. Yet my chest burned with emotions I could not yet name. So I turned my focus toward our shared goal, putting the tasks in chronological order, adding start and end dates. We put mid-Feb next to getting moving boxes and tape and get a quote for interior paint. Easy peasy. But when it came to decide what to keep, sell, or donate, my throat constricted and my brain became a brick. I remember doing this very task in 2014 when I was a new mom with postpartum anxiety and we were moving. I held up each of Gio's onesies and wondered if we should keep these clothes for a future sibling. Could I ever go through invasive IVF procedures and a terrifying C-section again? I remember doing this task in 2021 when I was 37 and had just lost my father to cancer. As I cleaned out his house and took a bag of his clothes to our car for donation, I stopped in the driveway, paralyzed. How could I possibly send all his button-ups to Goodwill and plant a for sale sign in his front yard when I had just held his shaking hand and watched his skeletal body writhe in pain? You see, home is complicated for me. When our son was born in Massachusetts, we brought him back from the hospital to the forever home we had purchased just before getting married, a cozy two-story built in 1908 with exposed wood beams and a leaning granite foundation. Our realtor, a man in his 60s who had lost his wife to cancer and knew what a ruse forever plans were, said that when we sold this starter home in a few years, we'd have to contend with the same potential buyer complaints we had had: the busy road, the one bathroom. Sell it? We were never leaving this idyllic home with its potbelly stove and huge yard. We'd even planted a tree in that very yard shortly after our son was born, and the plan was that it would grow as he grew. We put that house on the market before Gio turned one, and since then, we've lived in the Midwest and the South, in city apartments, suburban rentals, and a purchased house on a lake in Illinois we thought would be our next forever home. We even lived for a summer in a 27-foot Airstream camper as we road-tripped around the U.S. What happened to cause all these moves? Missing my family, needing a village to raise our son, being overwhelmed by city life, the pandemic, the pursuit of a sunny town that might ease my winter blues, and some unexpected, heartbreaking events I never could have fathomed. Basically, life happened. Now we're in Florida and Gio is finishing seventh grade. We've got 5 years before he flies the nest. I'm deeply aware that having a home at all is a great privilege, and the house we're renting is a perfectly good house. Gio's buddies come over after school all the time. They jump on the trampoline, talk to Winston the leopard gecko, and play Minecraft. It has held our after-dinner dance parties to Freedom by George Michael. It has doubled as an office for Jamie and me. But when the owner texted in December asking if we were going to renew our lease, we added up the amount of money we've spent in rent since 22 and had to pick ourselves up off the floor from shock. My God. Since arriving in Florida, we've been waiting out the market, which was absolutely bananas when we first moved here, and it has slowed. Houses are sitting, prices are dropping. Last month, we decided it was time to start actively looking. Late one night, scrolling on Zillow, I found a little ranch house with a screened-in porch and a big backyard. When we drove through the neighborhood, my heart warmed for the first time in a long time. When we walked in with the realtor the next day, the light poured in from every window, and I breathed a sigh of relief. I felt Jamie watching me. "It's good to see you like this," he said. The truth is that I've been holding my breath here in this town. It doesn't feel like my forever place. We've made wonderful connections, but there's a sense of temporariness since so many people come and go. I miss my mom and sister and new niece. The truth is, if Gio weren't so happy here, we'd probably be thanking this place for a mostly good few years and saying goodbye. But instead, we're buying a house. While parts of the decision seem illogical, we're trying to do something smart for our future. We're taking the money we would have thrown away in rent and investing it into something for ourselves that will hopefully pay off one day when we sell it. Also, I can sense deep in my bones that Gio needs stability right now. His school is incredible and his friendship bonds are strong. He is deeply enmeshed in his martial arts community. Of course, I don't believe you should stay in any place, job, or marriage for your child if it's making you miserable. They can sniff out your rotting resentment in a second. Jamie and I have moved Gio in the past because it was the right thing for us as individual people with our own needs. And I'm not miserable. There are plenty of things I enjoy here. Beach walks, paddleboarding, a good group of neighbors. Still, I feel uncommitted, and I've never owned a home I did not originally plan to be in forever. It's like getting married to someone you know you're going to divorce in the not too distant future. In fact, we've lived in so many places for just a few year span that it feels like something I can't seem to get right. The lack of belonging, the lack of deeply mattering to a physical community is part of what burns in my chest. It's how we as humans sometimes feel when we want a long-term partnership or a fulfilling career but can't seem to find one. Or when we had what we thought would be something deep and lasting, and then it didn't work out for one reason or another. I remember years ago after an IVF transfer when we had to wait 2 weeks to see if I was pregnant, and the nurse said to be cautiously optimistic. Well, that's an oxymoron, I thought. But I tried it. I let my heart hold a bit of hope in addition to the caution. But when we got the negative results 2 weeks later, it didn't save me from one bit of devastation. So now, rather than feeling cautiously optimistic about big transitions, I just feel, well, cautious. Despite still being eternally rosy in some areas of my life, I've closed my heart off to hope when it comes to others, and home is one of them. I'm sometimes afraid to consider what my future looks like. I know it's a protective response, me bracing myself for whatever unexpected event waits around the corner, just when I've started to let my guard down. I never saw a post-egg retrieval hemorrhage coming, nor deep postpartum loneliness, nor my father's cancer diagnosis at 57, nor passing the keys of my Illinois home off to a new buyer. I guess I'm afraid to commit to anything long-term anymore, especially a home. So you can see why the spreadsheet discussion with Jamie was not really about the spreadsheet. Decide what to keep, sell, or donate. Will I need this for my future life? What will my future even look like? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I love a good plan because it gives me a false sense of security, but I should know better by now. Almost everything in my life has not gone according to plan, not just for the worse, but for the better too. Meeting my Bostonian husband at the Green Iguana Bar in Tampa, leaving my full-time professor job to start my online women's writing community, getting pregnant naturally with Gio after years of brutal procedures and being told it was impossible. Decide what to keep, sell, or donate. What date do you want this done by? I asked Jamie, seeing he'd be the one taking our items to the donation center. I hoped he'd say 3 weeks from now, so I could put it off the way I put off anything hard. How about this Saturday, he said. Valentine's Day? My whole body went hot. I didn't really give two craps about Hallmark holidays, but doing the emotional work of considering the fate of household items instead of going on a hike or dinner date the way we did in our early years felt especially depressing. He was in project manager mode, wanting to move things along so I did not procrastinate and bottleneck them. I was in emotional processing mode, wanting to reconnect and have a heart-to-heart over all that was going on inside of me. Maybe we should take a break from this, Jamie said, sensing my frustration. And I considered going upstairs to stew about the state of our marriage. And then I remembered something from an essay I wrote 8 years ago. Marriage is hard right now because life is hard right now. I took a deep breath, gathered myself, and opened up a little about why the spreadsheet was so difficult for me. "I understand," Jamie said. And that was that. We expanded the done-by-date to Sunday and decided to reward ourselves this weekend by doing something non-house-related. Jamie warmed up the pasta, we ate dinner with Gio, and we readied ourselves for bed. The next day, I wrote this essay and read it to Jamie. "I knew this was hard for you," he said, "but I didn't realize all that." "I think I'm still traumatized by everything," I said, then thought of how he'd lived through all of the same heartaches. "We both are." Jamie nodded. "I think I've pushed it all down," he said. "I think I've gone numb." It felt honest and true. I could talk about commitment right now and spin this into a bow-tied ending that focuses on our 20-year partnership and how good it felt to connect. But even as I attempted typing it, my fingers resisted it. That's not what this is about. When I came to my desk today to reread and share it, I was thinking of all the people who feel on Valentine's Day and any day that couplehood is shoved down their throats, the way I used to when I was going through IVF and cried at the pregnant women on Instagram, the way I currently feel when I observe multi-generational families who live together, when I see a community of people who all feel like they deeply belong. "Sometimes it's just hard," I said to Jamie. "And that's what feels true right now." Okay. So when I wrote this, it felt really true. I felt proud of it because I pushed myself to be honest. So let me take you behind the scenes into the making of it. When I sat down that night with Jamie and we were making the spreadsheet, I could feel that heat in my chest. That was the first bodily sign. And I was like, ooh, something's going on here. We're just talking about a spreadsheet, but I'm having a whole emotional moment. And then I noticed how I felt when he said, "Oh, let's do it Saturday." And I was like, "Valentine's Day? Really? Are you kidding me?" And I thought back to like our early years when we were didn't have much responsibility. We would go for hikes and romantic dinners. And I was like, "Wow, well, things have certainly changed." And I thought, "Oh gosh, there's something here." And I was thinking about how I knew that on Valentine's Day, so many people would be posting about their great partnership and how isolating and lonely it feels when you're going through the reality of life and everyone around you seems to be going along swimmingly. Everyone else seems to be deeply content. And so I knew when I sat down that my audience was going to be those people who need to know that other people are going through something too. So whenever I'm coaching someone about their writing, I oftentimes ask first about who their intended audience is, because that makes a huge difference. In graduate school, they used to have us write "Dear so-and-so" at the top of our scenes before we wrote the actual scene. Because if you're talking about your weekend and you're telling your friend versus your mom versus your neighbor versus a nun, your story is going to sound very different. Audience is really, really important. And I wanted to capture those people who feel the way that I feel when I read someone else's work where they're willing to tell the truth. I feel relief and I feel deep connection. And I've been wanting for a while now to write something deeper on Substack. I often use Substack newsletters as a way to, you know, tell people about a workshop that I'm leading or inform them about a podcast episode that just released. But I've been reading so much honest, compelling work by writers that I admire on there, many of them who've been guests on this show. And they've been pushing me internally to go deeper and be more honest. So when I read Molly Weisenberg's work and Helly Bateman's work and Laura McGowan's work and Shauna Nyquist's work, I am challenged to be more honest and more open. So when I first sat down, or when I first came to my desk. It's a standing walking desk. I turned on the treadmill and I went slowly and I just started typing. I at first was really light and easy breezy and kind of like making jokes about how ridiculous real estate is. And it's like, hey, want to take a huge leap on this property you've only spent 20 minutes at a time in twice with your realtor? Like they don't even let you sleep over for a weekend. They even let people test drive cars. They don't let you spend entire evenings in the home. And so I was making it very ha-ha. And right away I was like, no, I want to go deeper. There's something deeper here. And I kind of knew instinctively that I wanted to do what's called a frame structure, where I started with the spreadsheet moment that created the initial frame. And then in the middle, I was going to get to some backstory. And then I was going to return to the frame of the spreadsheet scene at the end. That I knew just instinctively. I wanted to ground us in scene, in real moment, before I gave the exposition of my backstory. And frame structures are super popular. Writers use them all the time because it grounds your reader in action before they're being told about backstory. And then even as I was writing, I was really trying to discover what it was about. I mean, oftentimes I don't publish something unless it's been deeply processed. And this was one of those moments that I was writing about in real time, just after it happened and while I was still feeling the emotions of it. So I was really trying to kind of figure it out on the page. Even though, of course, you know, people give the advice of writing from the scar rather than the wound, I do find that there are times that capturing the real time feeling of what was going on is deeply important. Jen Hatmaker talked about that on this podcast. Maggie Smith talked about that on this show as well, about sometimes how it's important to capture the wound in the moment. So I'm writing and I'm trying to go, why did I feel so heated about this spreadsheet, about having to figure out what furnishings to keep, donate or sell? You know, what was that all about? And I had articulated some of it to Jamie that night, like, you know, home is so hard for me. But then as I was writing and going back over it, and then later playing it out in my head as I went for a walk, I realized that I am skittish. I am like a dog in a pound who has been through a lot and is kind of shaking and skittish and very untrusting. And that's just the reality of it. I think it's a valid and normal trauma response when anyone has gone through many unexpected heartbreaks. And so I was like, okay, I knew that that was part of it. And so I wanted to capture some of those moments on the page. The voice I heard in my head said, oh, you've been here before. And I saw this moment of me holding up Gio's onesies as we were leaving Massachusetts. And I was like, well, gosh, I don't know whether to keep these or donate them. I don't know if we'll have another kid. I've just been through years of infertility treatments and hormone shots and my body being beat up and unexpected hemorrhaging post egg retrieval and a C-section that was just awful. And like, I cannot even fathom trying to do all that again. And yet, I don't know, in 3-4 years, I might. So do we hold on to this stuff? Like, what will my future even look like? I've barely even come up for breath after all that's just happened. And so I remembered feeling that way then. And then I remembered feeling that way packing up my father's clothes and being like paralyzed in the driveway of his home as I was about to put them in the back of the car. And just thinking like, these aren't just clothes. Like, will the people at Goodwill who end up buying these clothes or receiving these clothes, will they know that they were worn on my father's body? That just a few days ago, I held his hand as he was barely conscious, but shaking in pain. And he was so thin and wearing this adult diaper, and he was covered in bruises and had wires going all over. And he was shaking from pain. He was in so much pain. And it's like, these items, these objects, they're not just things. They carry so much weight, and deciding on keeping or donating is not an easy decision. What we're really coming up against is, can we still hold on to hope for a sunny future when our past has been equal parts sunny and equal parts devastating landslide? You know, that became the real question. And in my Write Well women's writing community, where I lead workshops and retreats, I often talk about this central question. Every scene, every story has a central question. And mine really became that, this idea of being cautiously optimistic. I remembered that as I was writing it, the IVF nurse saying to be cautiously optimistic. And it's like, well, actually, all I feel right now is cautious. And investing in anything for your future, a home, making any sort of decision for your future, is asking you to extend a bit of blind faith and hope that things will work out to a certain extent. Otherwise, you wouldn't be investing any time or energy or effort into that future. And so it's also asking you to take the deep pain you've been through and hold it, but also take a blind leap that the future will be unknown in bad and good ways. But really, truly, it's facing that life is both things. It's just sometimes hard. And as I was reading the mostly finished essay to Jamie, that's what I came to at the end, that sometimes it's just hard. And maybe we can be cautious and the optimism is there, but we don't have to force it to arise. Maybe we can just carry on into our futures step by step, feeling cautious, but not feeling ashamed to be cautious and holding ourselves really tenderly despite feeling cautious, because there's a great reason for that caution. And that in and of itself, holding ourselves, making space for ourselves, saying to ourselves, yeah, it's really hard right now, is in and of itself a sort of hopefulness, a sort of love. And so essentially, we're investing in ourselves. That's what I wanted to capture. That's what I hope I captured. I hope that hearing this and hearing the thought and writing process behind it inspires you if you're a creative, to resist the urge to tie it all up with a pretty bow and challenge yourself to be more honest, the way I did at the very end of that essay when, you know, I could have wrapped it up in a pretty bow, but instead I kept pushing myself to be more honest. So I hope in some ways it does that. But then I hope just as a human that this essay encourages you to make space for all that is and to hold yourself through all the moments, especially the hard ones. I could just spend all day talking about writing, which reminds me, if you would like to spend an entire week focused on your writing, remember I have those retreats coming up. The one in August in Wisconsin through the Madeline Island School of the Arts, and the other one in Spain about tiny true stories and sketches. You can find them all on my website at NadineKennyJohnstone.com. Thank you, my friends. If you love this show and if you loved this episode, please feel free to share it with a friend. Please like, subscribe, follow, leave a review, all the things. It really, really helps. If you want to check out any of my future offerings as a writing coach, I have lots of workshops and retreats coming up. You can find them all at NadineKennyJohnstone.com. And big thanks to my dear producer, Michelle Rado, for always making this show the best that it can be. Remember, everyone, every heart has a story, and every story has a heart. See you next time.